and welcome to this week's TES News podcast. I'm Dave Speck, and joining me is the TES News team. We've got reporter John Roberts. Hiya, John.
Hello there.
We've got reporter Catherine Luff. Hiya, Catherine.
Hello. Hi.
And also joining us, we've got deputy news editor Mary Louise Clues. Mary Louise, hello.
Hi there.
Now, coming up, we have why recycling GCSE questions, which pupils have already seen this year, might not be unfair. And we've got the latest on the DfE's drive to improve behaviour in schools. But first, the news which has been dominated this week by, what is it, anyone? That thing that's been happening this week all week?
Just the largest teaching union's conference, annual conference, I think.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. Yeah, of course, the NEU has been holding its annual conference this week. It's been happening online. I've got the 70-odd page agenda in front of me. It's a bit of a monster. And all week, since Wednesday, delegates have been backing all sorts of campaigns to abolish Ofsted, reduce workload. There's been a call for a moratorium on exclusions during the pandemic and an end to sexual harassment of women teachers. Where do you start? I mean, what about you lot? Has anything stood out from the conference for any of you? What have been the highlights?
Well, Dave, I was going to ask you, actually, because it's been a year of, you know, excessive strain and pressure, as we've been reporting throughout the year during the pandemic on teachers, and a year in which we've seen a pay freeze. So I imagine that the unions the leadership is sort of under pressure to represent their members and represent how they're feeling. I just wondered if there's been any sign of any talk of strike action at the conferences this season.
Yeah, I mean that's a good question. I think when you talk about strike action, Motion 10 was on the public sector pay freeze, and that was backed by 99% of delegates. And it made quite a long list of demands, including that the NEU would work with any other unions to develop a coordinated campaign to challenge this pay freeze. There was another demand a call on the union's executive to submit a claim to the STRB, the School Teachers Review Body. You know, this body the independent body that advises on teacher pay. And they were going to ask them to restore real terms pay to 2010 levels for teachers within 3 years. And within that, there was a call for a 7% pay rise for next year. And there was also a call to restore national pay bargaining, to restore mandatory pay scales and to end performance-related pay. And all of these demands, if they're not met, the union said, and these are the exact words of the motion, we will use surveys of members to build towards a ballot for national strike action at an appropriate time, with all tactical options considered, should the government not meet our demands, and we'll seek involvement of other trade unions where possible. But I know, John, this is something you know about, because, and I've probably asked you this, John, what is the likelihood of the union being able to get national strike action, given this Trade Union Act that came into force?
Yeah, well, exactly. So if you look back to like the early part of the last decade, the NUT, which is kind of one of the forerunner unions of the NEU, twice had national strike action in 2014, 2016 over pay. But since then, trade union legislation has meant it's harder to get to the threshold they need. They need half of their members taking part in a ballot and then the majority of those to vote on action. I think the last strike they did, they had something like the ballot was something like a quarter of the overall membership took part, so it wouldn't have
even met the first threshold.
Exactly. So, and I think that, as you say, that shows in the way that they've kind of worded the that motion, is like strike action's kind of almost like something we aspire to, but not something we can go to, because they don't know that they can always get there. And I think one of the things that struck me about so many of the motions was that the union was being instructed to campaign for things rather than take industrial action. Mm. It's almost more of a campaigning voice than a kind of a...
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe shows the kind of changing face of trade unionism, because in a sense, the profession is probably as disillusioned with government over various things as it ever has been coming out of COVID, and particularly a lot of the kind of activists and delegates at an NEU conference. But it was, it's quite striking, I think, that a lot of the calls to action are calls to campaigns now, whereas I've kind of been reporting on education for a long time now, on and off. And when I think back to some of the NUT conferences I went to in the kind of late noughties, early 2010 years, industrial action was almost kind of a, we call for it on this and we'll call for it on that.
Yeah.
Do you mean it was just sort of a go-to thing that we'll consider this? And I think it's quite striking that it's obviously less part of their day-to-day thoughts because it is just more difficult for them to achieve. Whilst I'm rambling, the other thing that struck me about it, I think, was the speech from the leaders, the Joint General Secretaries, Kevin Courtney and Mary Bowston.
Mm.
It struck me that it was a lot about a kind of a vindication of some of the decisions they've taken over COVID over the last year. It almost felt like a political party conference where they and I can understand why they've done it, because they basically said, look, we were right about this, and we were right, you know, we were right to call for schools to close, we were right to call for a circuit breaker, we were right to call for rotas, right to call for schools not to come back in January when they did for a day. And I think it shows that it's just interesting that they felt the need to say that and to kind of justify the stances they've taken. But they also said that their membership had grown by, I think it's about 35,000 over the course of this period. So obviously it's kind of the stance they've taken has held sway with a lot of people. But yeah, that was the thing that really struck me, was that it was rather than being about the members' direct working lives, the initial focus of the main speech was, this is what we said as a union and we were right to say it. And just one last little bit, I think a lot of people might look at, you know, I think it's fair to speculate and to wonder, had any of these measures that the NEU asked for actually happened, would that have made a difference to COVID transmission in December? Would it have made a difference to hospital admissions and death rates in January? I think it's a fair question to ask, because we're living in a time really where political decisions have immediate real world consequences. So yeah, that was the thing that really struck me about their speech.
That's really interesting. John, because I noticed that, I mean, we've covered, I was going to ask you about this as well, Dave, but we covered the NASUIT conference over the Easter weekend, Dr. Patrick Roach's speech, as well as the General Secretary's of the NEU today. And it was striking how similar in terms of the theme around talking about teachers being treated with contempt, and mentioning the sort of pay freeze issue. In fact, that was a really similar theme across those speeches that I noticed, Dave. Was that something that you were struck you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I thought Patrick Roach is he mentioned obviously in his speech that the government had treated teachers with contempt by not rewarding their efforts with a pay rise. And Patrick's speech, by his own admission, was an absolute monster. I mean, it was a huge mammoth thing, and he said a lot of stuff in that. But one of the things that I picked up, because I covered the NASWIC conference as well, was something that he said separately, and that was in response to Gavin Williamson's speech. He gave a speech at NASWIC, and Gavin Williamson, he said that he had made this admission that far too many teachers were leaving the profession. And then he also spoke about the fact that improved teacher training would be the key to catch up as we come out of the pandemic. And Patrick Roach sort of retaliated, knocked back against this. And he said, well, you know, that makes it look like teachers were the problem are part of the problem. And it's interesting because, I mean, you know, Gavin Williamson obviously must be more pally with the NASUWT than he is with the NEU. I don't think he's particularly pally with either of the unions, but it's interesting that he appeared at the first conference, not at the second one.
I think the NEU have taken a much more, I'm searching for the right word, but they've really stuck their heads above the parapet, haven't they, during the COVID, and have been really, really critical and really haven't pulled their punches. And maybe that's been reflected in his choice of which conference to speak at. I'm not saying it has, I haven't got any inside track on that, but that struck me as well.
I tell you what, I think one similarity between the two conferences was the stance on replacing GCSEs and A-levels with moderated teacher assessments, because I think neither conference each conference had a motion on that, and neither conference backed it. And I know that yesterday, the day before, the NEU conference had this motion to replace GCSEs and A-levels with moderated teacher assessments, and that got sort of changed. And I think me and you worked on this one at the weekend as well at NASWIT, Mary Louise, because the reason that got knocked back at NASWIT was because it was felt that it would create too much workload for teachers, and they would be open to bullying by parents and that sort of thing.
One thing I was going to kind of mention was that obviously it got knocked back, but then in another motion that they then did vote to pass to campaign for a development of curriculums and assessment that that incorporate global perspectives, and this was part of a motion in response to Black Lives Matter. And it said, you know, to replace current examination systems at GCSE and A-level. So that was yesterday. So it's interesting that sort of the main motion on exams had, you know, was knocked back at conference. But then this other motion, which did have this point about campaigning for a new kind of assessment system, did go through. I suppose for the other motion, it doesn't necessarily say to replace them with teacher assessment. It says that there needs to be a system that incorporates global perspectives to replace GCSEs and A-levels. Right. So that is a slightly different thing, actually.
But just while you're on this subject of GCSEs, Catherine, which is, of course, your favourite subject and you're the GCSEs expert, but tell us about this story, and forgive me, I am moving away from the conferences now. I hope I'm not moving away too early. But sorry, Mary-Louise, go on.
No, I just wanted to mention the other thing, the other issue that was raised yesterday that's really topical at the moment with the discussions around sexism, sexual harassment in schools.
Was the motion
where a lot of female teachers talk really passionately about the issues around a laddish culture in secondary schools. And what really struck me about this was I hadn't really heard so sort of frankly before about kind of how female teachers feel sidelined and feel harassed in secondary schools. Yeah. They talk about an overwhelming culture of sexism and laddish culture. And one of the, I think the person that proposed the motion to campaign against this and to kind of educate or just raise the issue in secondary schools. It sounded like she was sort of almost pleading with her colleagues to saying, male teachers, can you just believe us when we tell you that we're suffering this kind of harassment? Sorry, Dave, you can say.
No, because she appealed to my union brothers to please believe when we tell you that we are being catcalled, we are being touched when we don't want to be, we are being shouted at. I was listening. And it was a very moving speech. It was a delegate from Newcastle, and she spoke brilliantly on the subject. And you know, I had no idea that naively. Yeah. I mean, we don't go in schools a lot, but I mean, you know, it's quite shocking, really. That's what I wanted to say. Yeah,
I just think, you know, if we're sort of in the wider debate about kind of educating young girls or young people about sexual harassment and about kind of acceptable and accepted behaviour. If the places, the very places where they're learning a lot of those codes and behavioural codes and where they're being shaped, are kind of, if the adults in those places are suffering from that kind of behaviour, and you know that it's just something that's, yeah.
What chance have the girls got, the school girls got, if the teachers are suffering it as well, kind of thing?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
But for a profession with 70% of the workforce is female, you know, that, as you were saying earlier, that's quite alarming, this is happening.
Absolutely. I think the proportions might be more equal in secondary schools, I'm not sure. I think it might be more 50-50. which would kind of explain why there might be a slightly different culture and why they're talking about culture in secondary schools. With older peoples as well.
I feel there's loads to talk about more at the conferences, and I know we've sort of already had 15 minutes of this podcast and we've got other things to talk about, but I mean, it is all on the website. I'm not just saying that to sort of plug our website, but we have reported loads and loads, haven't we? We've covered loads of motions, and so it's all there for people to read. But Catherine, let me talk to you about this GCSE story that you've written today, that exam boards are defending recycling questions for GCSE and A-levels this year that pupils may have already seen. I mean, that can't be fair, can it?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things with this is that it's based on the fact that the kind of optional external tasks released by exam boards are based on past papers which were kind of in the public domain anyway, and in a way that was exactly kind of what we were expecting, really. But I think there has been some concern about this from teachers, from school leaders. Even though these external tasks are optional, a lot of schools I've heard from are running them sort of as a series of mock exams or really in a way that is a formal assessment that students will sit and do in silence, kind of like an exam. And so teachers, school leaders previously have kind of said, you know, is this a problem? Will students go away and learn past paper stock answers by rote? And will that sort of artificially inflate the grades? So interestingly, I spoke to some of the exam boards about this, and in particular OCR, and they had researchers looking into this, and they found that it's an under-researched area whether students benefit from doing a question which they've seen before. But it doesn't, they said, seem to kind of radically affect performance. And they said that it doesn't necessarily create an unfair advantage for students to sit a paper that they might have seen before, perhaps some months before, that isn't a huge advantage for them. And they've drawn on some research about that.
Okay. Well, that's a story that's on our website. John, can I ask you about the DfE's latest drive to tackle behaviour? This has been a hugely well-read story on our website in the last couple of days.
Yeah, it feels like the department made a big noise about this week. The Education Secretary wrote in the Telegraph as sort of trailing the announcement. So, basically, it's something that's actually been in train for a long time. They first announced this, or the kind of the outline for this plan, before, perhaps even before Boris Johnson's government, like middle of 2019, certainly pre-pandemic, a good while ago. So basically, it's behaviour hubs, £10 million going into the creation of kind of centres of excellence that will support schools that need help on behaviour. They announced the 22 schools that are going to be leading on that this week, and it'll start from after Easter. So it is now going to be on the ground. And to introduce that, Gavin Williamson wrote about behaviour and this plan, but he kind of linked it. There's two aspects to what he wrote about that proved quite controversial, I think. The first is that he kind of linked it to the pandemic, in that he said that it's inevitable that pupils who've been in the lockdown will lack structure and discipline. And I think that's proved a little bit contentious, because there's been some suggestions from government and from the sector as well that actually behaviour hasn't deteriorated, that students have responded well, that students have responded well to being back in school. And so there's been some questioning about, on what basis are you making that, you know, claim? Well, where's the evidence for that, that this is a post-lockdown problem? And the other thing was that he kind of returned to something that feels like a real kind of talking point for people outside of education, I think, which is that he said, remote education has been great, technology has been great, but now it's time to put the screens away. And he's talking about removing mobile phones from the school day. And that seems to be a subject that sort of triggers people a little bit, I think, because it feels to some like he's trying to appeal to his kind of party base with a kind of a core old-fashioned message about discipline. I think there'll be lots in the sector who say, well, look, we don't have mobile phones in the classroom. You know, we do have school policies about this. You can't have kids distracted by devices 24/7. And he also said some stuff about how mobile phones can fuel cyberbullying and And it's kind of important for people as kind of old and grey and jaded as me to remember that kids are growing up in a very different world now. Do you know what I mean? And technology means different things. So that was interesting. But yeah, it's been criticised because I think partly because this plan was already in post before the pandemic. And so linking it to the pandemic seemed interesting and odd to some. But also just because behaviour is such a divisive issue in the sector, I think, particularly in social media, the way behaviour, I don't think of any other issue where behaviour and the sanctions that flow from it get debated in such an adversarial way. And so it's kind of reignited all that kind of debate. And Jeff Barton's done his column this week on our website touching on this and basically saying post-pandemic, there's so much that the Education Secretary could have chosen to focus on in terms of recovery, in terms of the how we tackle education inequalities of opportunities as part of the levelling up agenda. And instead he's chosen to focus on banning mobile phones. That is sort of a cosmetic distraction. I think those involved would hope that the behaviour thing is not that it's something fundamental. So it's been led by Tom Bennett, who's the, I think we described as the government's behaviour czar, and he's got a team of advisors, and they've kind of been instrumental in selecting these schools. And it's starting quite small, 22 schools, working with a couple of schools, but the vision is over 3 years that it'll reach 500 schools. I think it's interesting that they've linked it to the pandemic. But the other thing that's interesting about it is the criteria for the schools they've chosen, they all had to be outstanding, rated by Ofsted. And that begs the question of whether you're going to get schools with different types of cohort. I think it's quite well established that it's more difficult for a school with a more disadvantaged cohort to achieve an outstanding grade. Does it therefore make it more difficult for a school with a challenging cohort to be one of these schools? There's a cross-section of secondary, primary, some special schools, a PRU, an alternative provision, and there is a geographic spread as well. So they have, I think the government have definitely tried to make sure that they've got the country covered and at least different types of sector covered so that I think, again, the idea is that a school can help a school in a similar context, if that makes sense. So they've got kind of experts in different parts of the patch. But it's definitely, as ever, with anything when we focus on behaviour, it's such a divisive issue for the sector.
Well, I mean, it's worth noting from the NASWAC conference that their top of their agenda was this motion on behaviour. And on the day it started, they put out this research which showed that 1 in 10 teachers had received threats of physical violence from students in the last year. And that's obviously during the pandemic. I don't think they released figures for the year before, but I mean, it's still pretty high, isn't it?
No, just to say they seem to be like, it's consistently an issue that they've kind of campaigned and highlighted, I think. And yeah, I think it's absolutely, it's one of those things that's probably more shocking for people outside the sector than in it. You forget when we talk so much about how subjects are taught and exams and the politics of education, it's easy to forget, I think, from the outside that the kind of the culture of the classroom is something the teachers have to work in, manage, control, and basically kind of dictates their lives, or, you know, not dictates, but it is their life, effectively.
The new president of the NASUWT, Phil Kemp, I had a really good interview with him. And in fact, he's in TES magazine out today. So that's a little plug for that. But on the photographs, you'll see he's completely bald. And he said to me quite openly, he said, look, I've been called a bald this and a bald that by pupils. And he said, you've got to let it go. You've got to absorb it. And you've got to move on. And by the way, he does work in alternative provision. He manages a unit up in the Newcastle area. Talking about the soft skills that you need to tackle, you know, hugely personal insults. And he says, you've got to understand where it's coming from. It's not you that the directing it at. It's just that they're angry. And he sort of says that the key skill is being able to rebuild as quickly as possible that relationship after a pupil has exploded and just carry on so that they can be back learning where they need to be. Now, I thought it was hugely, it was a really brilliant interview. He's a great guy, really open and not afraid to, you know, to really speak his heart. When you talk about behaviour, I think the soft skills are so important, and that's one thing that's come up this week.
Yeah, I think the other thing that struck me from the debate is that there are kind of different approaches to behaviour, different philosophies about it, I think. And what one thing a lot of school leaders have said is that the context is really important. So maybe the way that an alternative provision or perhaps a PRU or a special school or a primary or a secondary deals with it, it, you know, will vary depending on the culture of their school and the ethos of it. And so I suppose that's another test for this programme, is how broad will the expert schools be? Will it just be one type of approach, or will it be a breadth of approaches? That's the other thing that I'd mention.
Mm. Should we wrap it up there? Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you all next week.
Cheers. Bye.
See you next week.
Thanks. Bye.